Artist, poet, and spiritual rebel, William Blake confided to a barrister near the end of his life in 1825 that a man should have access to concubines to fulfill God's duty. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. Welcome to the erotic spiritual vision of one of England's most celebrated artists, whose work is about to go on display at the National Gallery of Victoria in Melbourne. You're listening to The Spirit of Things on RN. William Blake's influence is as diverse as it is vast, from theologians like C.S. Lewis, who called him a genius, to mescaline experimenter Aldous Huxley, who published the celebrated book called after Blake's work, The Doors of Perception. Countless singer-songwriters like Bob Dylan and Led Zeppelin, TV shows like Monty Python and The Mentalist, and film directors like Martin Scorsese and Ridley Scott owe inspiration to William Blake. But who inspired him? And why was sex so central to his spiritual vision? It's a riveting story, and we'll hear it later when Marcia Keith Shuhard tells us about the spiritual subculture that set itself against the piety of English Puritanism. But closer to home, from the 4th of April, the National Gallery of Victoria in Melbourne will exhibit its considerable collection of William Blake's paintings, etchings, and drawings. Kathy Lay, senior curator of prints and drawings, tells me how the gallery came to acquire them at a time when the international interest in Blake was high.
The NGV purchased its works in 1918, and by 1923 the Tate Gallery had a room dedicated to the display of works by William Blake. In America, there had been quite considerable interest, particularly amongst private collectors, and there'd been a couple of museum exhibitions at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston as early as 1880 and 1891, and 1891 exhibition included a number of works that were borrowed by collectors. So in both Britain and America, there was considerable interest in Blake by that time.
So Melbourne's collection, which is considerable, must have made a lot of people very envious in the empire.
It's a very interesting story about how we purchased this great group of works. We bought 63 works in 1918 from a sale, quite a famous sale that was held in London in 1918, and it was the collection that had belonged to John Linnell, who was a painter, a friend, and the last great patron of Blake's final decade. And he'd put together this extraordinary collection, and the most important part of that collection were the 102 watercolours illustrating Dante's Divine Comedy, which was done right in the final 3 years before Blake died. These 102 drawings, watercolours, were consigned as a single lot, and there was a real concern amongst the British institutions, and you've got to remember these are the war years, given the scarcity of funds in Britain, that this great last set of Blake's years could actually go in its entirety to America, to some of the private collectors. So the NGV had very considerable funds in the early 20th century that came about through Alfred Felton, the great patron of the NGV, who left a sum of money in 1904. And from about 1910, we always had a Felton advisor in London. And by 1918, that was Robbie Ross, a very noted critic and art historian and friend of Oscar Wilde and executor of Wilde's estate. And he worked together with the directors of the British Museum and the Tate Gallery to put together a consortium bid. So they pooled their resources and were able to bid successfully for that group, and then they divided it amongst the various players who had contributed.
Well, anyone collecting William Blake's work, or indeed commissioning it, would have had to be prepared for not only Blake's very original visionary art, but often the fact that it included a lot of nudity.
Yes, yes. It's an interesting point, and I think there's perhaps a number of reasons for that. When Blake came to artistic maturity as a young artist in the late 18th century, neoclassicism was the prevailing mode that was very popular amongst young artists, and friends of Blake's such as John Flaxman and George Cumberland, actually travelled to Rome and to Italy to look at and study the art of classical antiquity. And I think you can see those influences in Blake's work. And of course, Blake was also very influenced by Michelangelo, and I think also the anatomies of Michelangelo, which also comes out of the classical antiquity, is an influence there. Perhaps the other reason for that is that, you know, Blake is illustrating a kind of personal mythology and a kind of the universal themes that he's trying to deal with. And he often sets his mythological stories in a kind of ancient period. And so I think the use of the nude figure ties in on both those levels.
Some of that universalism also made him a supporter of the abolitionist cause. So he would have been depicting slaves, and perhaps people don't realize that he also was the first to depict Aboriginal Australians.
That's interesting. You know, Blake trained as a professional engraver, and that's how he actually managed to support himself, even though at times really only very modestly throughout his life. By the late 1780s, one of his most regular employers was this very radical book publisher and bookseller, Joseph Johnson, and it was here that Blake met this kind of radical circle that included Thomas Paine, the author of The Rights of Man, Mary Wollstonecraft, and actually Blake illustrated, and she was a famous feminist, William Godwin, an author and anarchist. But it was here also that he met Captain Stedman, and he'd been an officer in the Scots Brigade. In 1772, was sent to the Dutch colony of Suriname in South America to put down a revolt. And Stedman kept a journal, and when he returned to England, set about publishing that. And Johnson commissioned about 80 plates, and 16 of those were done by Blake, and actually the majority of the ones depicting the punishments inflicted on the Negro slaves were done by Blake. And they're really quite extraordinary images. You see the kind of dignity of those figures. You know, they're being inflicted with terrible punishments that are detailed in Stedman's text, but Blake shows them suffering in silence, but with great dignity. And by the date that Blake was working on this particular book, which came out in early 1790s, he had already published poems such as Little Black Boy in The Songs of Innocence, where he talks about an African child achieving closeness to God without the aid of formal Christian instruction. So he was already interested in equality. And Blake and Stedman became close friends and visited each other. And it has been argued that this friendship did promote Blake's already strong ideas about equality of man and very strong anti-slavery ideals. And one of the poems in which that comes out is his 1793 poem called The Visions of the Daughters of Albion.
Well, from the cruel realities of slavery to Blake's very fertile mythological imagination, one of the illustrations that people will see is for his first book of Urizen. Can you tell us about the three figures in the painting?
Yes, this is a full-page illustration from the first book of Urizen, and that is one of Blake's so-called prophetic books, and he started on that series in 1793, and in them he developed his myth of human history from creation through to redemption. And in these books you see a cast of characters that Blake hasn't invented. And in the first book of Urizen, what Blake is exploring is this kind of central concept that the creation was a fall from grace that allowed the domination of reason over the poetic imagination. Urizen personifies reason. His counterpart is Los, and Los is in the image that personifies the imagination. Los's pity for Urizen causes his sexual division, and this other figure arises, and this is Enitharmon. She comes into being. And so Los and Enitharmon have a child who's named Orc, and he is, for Blake, symbols energy and the spirit of rebellion. And so what we see in this image is the trio of Los, Enitharmon and Orc, and we see the child Orc embracing his mother Enitharmon and looking up lovingly at her. Los had seen this embrace and was jealous, imagining that Orc was plotting his death. So the image shows Los bound by great chains, and these symbolise his passion and jealousy as he looks at Enitharmon and Orc.
It's very interesting because the young boy, who's not a baby, he's more like a prepubescent child, is cleaving to the mother, and of course they're all naked. It's a very forceful kind of sexual image there, and I wonder how the public would have reacted to these images.
That's a good question. These books, such as the first book of Urizen, were hand-printed by Blake, and they combined his images together with his poetry. And they were done in very small numbers. For the first book of Urizen, for example, there were only 6 copies of that book, and of his other prophetic books as well, you know, 6 through to about 13 copies. So they were really done for quite a small audience, a cognoscenti in a way, other artists or wealthy patrons. So Blake didn't have this broader audience. We do know in 1809, a little bit later than the first book of Urizen, Blake did mount a public exhibition. He was trying to reach a broader public, and this exhibition was held in the house of his brother. Unfortunately, it didn't receive much public attention, and it drew only one review, and that was very hostile, and in fact actually castigated Blake as unintelligible, actually for a broader audience where they weren't available but wouldn't have been understood.
He who binds to himself a joy doth a winged life destroy, but he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in it all. It is sunrise.
Well, Kathy, there was one publication that many English people did know, and that was Milton's Paradise Lost, for which he provided watercolours and engravings. How much creative licence did William Blake allow himself when he was illustrating this text?
Blake was a very creative and original illustrator, and this is seen both in Milton and in Dante. He had a long appreciation of Milton's poetry and had read it from a young man, and he first the first illustrations to Paradise Lost date from 1807-8. And what we see there in Blake's response to Milton is him taking issue with certain aspects of the poem. One of the long-held readings of Milton's Paradise Lost was that Milton had made Satan the hero of the poem. And in his cycle of illustrations, Blake redresses the balance there, downplaying the role of Satan and actually elevating the role of Christ. And he does this through giving really quite a pronounced emphasis upon Christ in various of the images, and actually within the sequence of images as a whole. Paradise Lost was illustrated by many other artists, and no other artist gave this kind of central role to Christ. We see it in one of the illustrations on display at the NGV, the marvellous image of the creation of Eve, where it's actually not God the Father who is raising Eve from the side of Adam, but actually Christ. Blake had a strong belief in the redemptive mercy of Christ and its role in the creation. So this is one way in which he played that out through the illustrations. Another is the other marvellous image that we have from Milton's Paradise Lost is the scene showing the endearments of Adam and Eve. And in this scene, we see Adam and Eve in a bower, and above it is the flying Satan. And Blake has included in that image a detail that's not in Milton's text, that Satan is entwined by the figure of the serpent. And he's looking down quite enviously at Adam and Eve. It's been interpreted that here Blake is actually projecting Satan as this kind of pathetic figure rather than this kind of very fearsome figure, powerful figure that comes across in Milton's poem.
John Linnell, who was William Blake's major patron near to the end of his life, also commissioned him to do, as you mentioned, Dante Alighieri's The Divine Comedy. How How well known was that book in England of the 1820s?
Dante's text had been undergoing a critical reevaluation by that time and was becoming far more broadly known. It was only in 1814 that the first complete translation of Dante's text was made available, and that was by Henry Carey. And it was through that text that the full text by Dante was known to the new younger generation of romantic poets such as Shelley and Coleridge, and became very influential. So certainly by the time Blake started on his set of illustrations in 1824, there was a broader appreciation of Dante's great text.
And how did William Blake, the religious revolutionary and visionary, deal with the theology of Dante, who was, after all, a 13th century Florentine?
And a Catholic.
And a Catholic, exactly.
And a Catholic. And Blake, of course, was a Protestant and a dissenting Protestant and fervently anti-Catholic. So it's a very interesting question. And I think what you see in Blake, again, as with Milton, he was a very creative illustrator. Blake always saw himself as an equal to the poets that he was illustrating, and so engaged quite directly with their texts. And so what you see coming through in his cycles of illustrations is not mere illustration, but at times where he's actually commenting upon it. So Blake read the text very, very carefully, and in fact he taught himself Italian. So he read the text very carefully, and that very close reading does come through in the details of the illustrations, but there were aspects of Dante's theology that he took exception to. He felt that Dante was too concerned with the material world rather than the world of the spirit, and he would often inscribe notations on the drawings while they're in progress. And so one of the drawings has the inscription, and I'll read it. Dante's Commedia shows that for tyrannical purposes he made this world the foundation of all, and the goddess Nature is his inspirer and not imagination. And that's for Blake. To be accused of materialism or putting nature above the imagination is a strong criticism. He also saw, I guess perhaps one of his major differences with Dante's Divine Comedy was that he saw the text as an act of vengeance and not of Christian forgiveness, which was so important to him. So the emphasis upon punishment that appears in all of the detailed descriptions of hell, Blake said, you know, Dante saw devils where I see only good.
But Kathy, he was so preoccupied with depicting hell, which is very interesting because you wouldn't expect so many of his illustrations to be focused on the tortures of hell.
That's right. Of the 102 illustrations, 72 of them depict hell. The series was unfinished at Blake's death, so it is possible that he was going to do further images on purgatory and paradise. But I think it's very clear that what inspired Blake the most was actually the depictions of hell, the descriptions of hell in Dante's text. And I think the marvellous level of detail that comes across in Dante's text that really inspired, and the imaginative detail, you know, the way in which Dante describes at length the different structures of hell, what it looked like, what the microclimates were, that in some levels there was freezing sleet and hails of rocks, in others there were roasting rivers and sulphurous fumes. And also the detailing of the sort of incredibly varied punishments that are meted out for the various categories of sins. Mm. Blake illustrates and responds to, I think, that level of detail. I think also Dante is very careful in his descriptions of the different times of day and light effects and these kind of atmospheric effects, and that is something that really does come through as well in Blake's watercolours. They're extraordinary for their rich technique and their evocation of all of these different areas of hell.
Well, they're certainly a lot more colourful than some of his paler pastel watercolours. But you've referred to this as his greatest work. What are the qualities that make you say that?
Look, I think it's the imaginative breadth and power of these works. They're the works of his late years, so there's a stylistic maturity that you see. His figures have a kind of three-dimensionality where you can see Blake looking back to Michelangelo and some of those influences that we talked about earlier. But there's also this wonderful grace to the figures. I think the technique of the works is incredibly rich and varied, so that with the watercolour technique he's able to evoke all of the detail of Dante's text. Blake really engages fully with it, but not only illustrating it, but also providing a commentary upon it, juxtaposing his own beliefs against those of Dante's. And I think that all of those elements add up to why this really is considered to be one of the culminating achievements of Blake's career.
Well, Kathy, today one can see so much of Blake's work on the internet, the poems, the illustrations. It's an absolutely fantastic resource. So how does that differ from actually seeing these paintings, these engravings in person?
It's always wonderful to see the works themselves. You get a sense of scale that you can never actually appreciate on the internet. We've got works in the show. The Songs of Innocence are really only tiny works, only about 8 centimetres by 6 centimetres. And you don't get that sense on the internet. The Thornton's Virgils are even smaller than that. The watercolours for Dante are very much larger. And of course, in reproduction, you never get the whole sense of the texture of the works and the extraordinary detail that can be conveyed through engraved line and drawing, you know, and the washes. So it's always a far better experience to sort of see the works in the flesh.
Well, I certainly agree, and congratulations on a very beautiful catalogue as well. Kathy Lay, it's been great talking to you.
Thanks so much, Rachel.
The exhibition of William Blake's works at the National Gallery of Victoria is from the 4th of April to the 31st of August, and it's free. And don't forget the catalogue by Kathy Lay has many reproductions of the works. And just check the Spirit of Things website for further details and a link. And of course, you can hear this program on your mobile when you're travelling on the bus, just by using the ABC Radio app. Well, composers were also inspired by William Blake, like Ray Vaughan Williams.
Piping down the valleys wild, piping songs of pleasant glee. On a cloud I saw a child, and he laughing said to me, pipe a song about a lamb. So I piped with merry cheer. Pipe a pipe that song again. So I piped, he wept to hear.
Do a search on the internet for the Moravians, and you'll soon find yourself in a web of esoteric and Christian reformist movements and underground societies. Originating in the Moravian part of Czechoslovakia, they moved on to Germany and to other parts of the world. It was in London that the Moravians exerted an influence and an attraction that would leave its mark on William Blake. Marcia Keith Shuhard is an independent scholar based in Atlanta, Georgia, who studied the complex world of theological ideas that pervaded Blake's life and work, and are most often depicted with an abundance of naked figures.
And I wrote my happy songs, every child may joy to hear.
Marcia Keith Shuhard, welcome to the Spirit of Things.
Thank you.
Well, I know you like to be called Keith, so I will address you as Keith in this interview. Now, we're going to be talking about William Blake, who wouldn't be the first artist whose paintings were subject to prudish comment and overpainting because of their racy and even blasphemous content. And it's that story of how he got that way, which, Keith, you've explored in your book with the intriguing title, Why Mrs. Blake Cried. Now, when did you first become interested in William Blake?
It came about quite indirectly because I was never interested in the literature of the 18th century, the Augustan age in England. It all seemed quite stuffy. and obsessed with minor literary squabbles. I was drawn instead to the modern writers, Irish writers, especially Yeats and James Joyce, because of their imaginative scope and their spiritual daring. It was their comments about Blake and about this underground secret tradition that intrigued me and set me off on quite a long historical quest.
Well, I must say your book was the most arousing reading I have ever done for a program.
Oh, dear.
Sex plays a very big role in the spiritual ideas that come to influence Blake, and I'd like to ask you about the different sources of those ideas, beginning with the Moravian congregation in Fetter Lane, which his parents belonged to. What sort of ideas pervaded the sectarian Moravians at that time?
At the time that Blake's mother and her first husband and his paternal uncle were all involved with the Moravians, they were going through something called the sifting time, in which was a kind of wild period of experimentation and radical behavior based on Count Zinzendorf, the leader of the Moravians, his studies in Jewish Kabbalah, in which he became quite interested in the whole notion of sacramental sexuality and a way of bringing sexuality back into religion in a very positive way.
I understand that mystical marriage was one of the ideas that the Moravians were involved with.
Yes, and this was something that was way beyond just a kind of airy mysticism. It was based on the Kabbalist belief that marital sex was a sacramental act, and that particularly for the Kabbalist who had meditated and worked himself up into a near visionary state, the conjugal act with his wife was something that had cosmic implications. So that in whatever humble bedroom they were having a direct effect on heaven and on God himself. What interested me was a comment by Raphael Patey, an Israeli anthropologist, who said that for the Kabbalist, God flowed into the sexual act while the act flowed into God, thus aiding the divinity himself in achieving a state of male-female togetherness, which God is just as much in need of as man. This was not something that I had come across in my puritanical Presbyterian upbringing.
Well, indeed, I think many people in London at that time were attracted to what was going on in the Fetter Lane congregation. And among them were the Wesleys, Charles and John Wesley, who founded the Methodists. Now, if one looks at the hymns that Charles wrote, there's some very graphic imagery there, physical imagery, that I wonder whether he got from the Fetter Lane congregants.
I think so very much. And John Wesley wanted very much to become part of the inner congregation, but they considered him a very turbulent man, too much ego, too much kind of bullying in his nature, and he was not accepted. And in his resentment, he had the breakaway into founding Methodism. But Charles was always more interested in the great Moravian tradition of music, of hymnology. And I think he retained much more of the Moravian influence than his brother did.
Keith, you write about the Moravians visualizing the body of Christ, in particular his wounds, and entering into them. What sort of connection would that visualization have with the work that William Blake would later produce?
This was probably the weirdest, but also the most attractive part of the Moravian theology, is that the side wound in Jesus was actually a vagina. It was the female part of Jesus, and the sphere, the soldier's sphere, was a phallic sphere. So in the penetration of the sphere into the side womb, there would be a gushing of blood and new souls born. And the Moravians sang to this. They had very, very lurid hymns to the side hole, as they called it. Blake's mother was particularly drawn to this and quoted in her letters how passionately she wanted to be absorbed in the blood until she could suck all the blood out of that wound. This kind of thing led to, of course, many criticisms. But it also focused on the body, that all parts of the body were the image of God. And for Zinzendorf, it was to make the male and female genitals be honored as the most honorable of all of the organs of the body. It was particularly the emphasis on the female genitals that I think was so new in a religious tradition, not particularly in the Orient or in some other areas. And it was an attempt to take seriously that man was made in the image of God, so that everything in man's body was part of the divine body.
Didn't William Blake actually draw pictures of the vagina as a Gothic chapel?
Yes, he did. He sketched the vagina with a small Gothic chapel in the middle of it. And this came directly from some of the Moravian hymns, the quotes about that. He also sketched a phallus as, someone said, the size of a signpost with three worshipers bowing down before it. And these were kind of tormented images, but they were also directly from Moravian sermons and hymns at the time.
Can you talk about the Moravian idea of the religion of the heart?
This, too, was very much drawn from Zinzendorf's studies in Kabbalah and his friendships with heterodox Jews. The Hebrew word for heart, lev, has much more in it than what we think of as heart. The heart was the inner person with five active senses, and it was in Hebrew and particularly Jewish mystical traditions, a kind of throbbing center of sensuality and vision, of imaginative vision. So the religion of the heart was one about bringing the body full-heartedly into a spiritual condition. And they would talk about being very hearty in their lovemaking or very hearty in their prayers and devotion. And this went far beyond what the English word heart would connote.
Did this have something to do with the love feast that the Moravians also celebrated? What went on in those love feasts?
Well, most of the time, these were quite innocent, and most of the Moravians were not involved in the more radical fringe of the group. It would be a gathering with food and maybe wine and beer. They actually had some breweries, and a great deal of singing, mutual prayer, etc. When Zinzendorf's young son, the kind of beautiful and androgynous Christel, came to London, he brought a much more radical element into this, and many of the love feasts, according to critics and even observers, became quite orgiastic in many ways. But this was still a minority of the Moravians, which I should stress.
And into that Moravian congregation in Fetter Lane, a number of interesting people came, and one of them was Emanuel Swedenborg, who was a free thinker, I think a scientist. You've written extensively on Swedenborg. What sort of interest did he have in this spiritualized sexuality?
Well, we know now, in fact, more evidence has come out beyond what I had in my book, that Swedenborg did participate in all of this. And he was drawn very much to this whole notion of the mystical marriage, and also to the Kabbalistic techniques of how to achieve vision. He would take it much further. He eventually broke with the Moravians, particularly when scandals, you know, became quite public. But he extended the notion of the mystical marriage into his idea of conjugal love, which would be continued into the afterlife, in which the male would have eternal virile potency, a phrase I loved, in order to maintain a kind of blissful orgasmic state for the married couple in heaven. And they didn't have to be the married couple from earth, but each man could find his own perfect spiritual mate after death.
Well, wasn't William Blake rather frustrated with his own wife and imagined that he might have these unions with others that would help him on this journey?
Yes, these techniques of meditation, which by this time also included yogic and tantric techniques, but which came through the Moravians' contacts with Asian, and they converted many yogis into Moravianism. But they're quite difficult. They require real mental and physical control of glands, muscles, breathing, etc. And the purpose is to achieve sexual arousal without proceeding all the way to ejaculation in order to maintain what they call the marriage in the mind. It could be kind of telepathic between the husband and the wife, or it could be just within the individual meditator. They're quite difficult and demanding. Blake's wife was a simple housewife who just worked and slaved to look after his printing business, look after him, who was not an easy character. And she apparently aged quite dramatically from the time when she was a blooming young bride, so that it was quite hard on her to have these kind of demands made on her. And when she couldn't do what he wanted, when she couldn't, as Swedenborg said, kindle his fiery desire, Swedenborg said, well, then the man can get a concubine. That this is so important. If he's going to have a spiritual life, he has got to be able to be kindled with his fiery desire. Well, this did not sit well with poor Catherine Blake.
And that's probably why she cried.
Oh, there were, yes, floods and floods of tears. They're all through the poetry. They're through the anecdotes with Blake's friends about them. These were intermittent because quite often they were a happily married couple, but there were also times that were quite tortured for them.
Well, concubinage, of course, had a basis in the Bible, so
yes.
Blake would have felt as if he was being a Bible-centric sort of person.
Yes, and in the Daughters of Albion, one of his more radical poems, he called for, you know, groups of girls and that his wife should sit there happily watching them copulating bliss on bliss in sunny daylight. But Zinzendorf also preached that polygamy was okay today because that was in the Old Testament and the New Testament had changed all of those laws.
So how much of a Christian was William Blake? Because a good deal of his art illustrates some visions of his own, sort of mythic stories of his own.
Well, he considered himself a very strong Christian, but he also said that the strongest Christian is the greatest voluptuary. So this was, you know, his own definition of that. But he was a Christian Kabbalist and believed in the divine human, that all the universe formed one cosmic man, which also a belief shared by Zinzendorf and Swedenborg. As he wrote later, my Jesus will not do either for Christian or Jew. He knew he was onto something quite different.
That's Marcia Keith Shuhart on the artist and poet William Blake. You're listening to The Spirit of Things on RN Radio Australia and online. And this is Chapter 12 of Blake's Songs of Innocence that conveys just what Keith was talking about.
To mercy, pity, peace, and love, all pray in their distress, and to these virtues of delight return their thankfulness. For mercy, pity, peace, and love is God our Father dear. And mercy, pity, peace, and love is man his child in care. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dress. Then every man of every clime that prays in his distress prays to the human form divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. And all must love the human form, in heathen, Turk, or Jew. Where mercy, love, and pity dwell, there God is dwelling too.
So this was a universalist vision, a kind of universal brethren or brotherhood, and that makes me think of some of the other ideas that were around at the time, such as Freemasonry. Were the people who were involved in Freemasonry also circulating in this milieu?
Well, yes, but not in regular English Freemasonry, which was very much establishment and supportive of the government. But there was the Jacobite or oppositional Freemasonry, which Swedenborg was very active in. And many of Blake's friends were, too. These were in opposition to the ruling Hanoverians in England. They were the ones who maintained the underground esoteric traditions. Regular mainstream Freemasonry was very rationalistic and Newtonian, but it wasn't the only one. There were two powerful forces going on within Freemasonry at that time, in conflict with each other.
Going back to the influence of the Kabbalah, which, as you say, was really a Christian form of Kabbalah. Can you spell out what that visionary experience was about that centered on the Holy of Holies and the cherubim who were kind of in an embrace over the Ark of the Covenant? What did that have to do with the sorts of visions that William Blake and others were trying to achieve?
Well, in Blake, it was particularly important, and he illustrated it, he wrote about it, etc. The fact that the cherubim had been separated, the male and female cherubim, which according to Jewish tradition, in the Temple of Solomon, and then in the Herodian Temple, there was a golden sculpture of a male and female entwined in sexual embrace. And when the temple was destroyed, they were paraded in the streets and mocked by the Jews' enemies. And the image of the separated cherubim, the separated male and female aspects of God, became very much a part of Jewish mystical traditions from then on. Blake picked this up very much and constantly writes about the cherubim and the need to bring them back together in what was a Hieros Gamos, a kind of mystical marriage that was not only earthly but also cosmic.
And these cherubim were in some way an emanation of God, that is, the male and female elements of God?
Yes, because in the Kabbalah, God contains both male and female potencies. And by emanations, the Sephiroth, they descend out of God and separate the male from the female and eventually will reach a point of holy marriage. But this is something that the Kabbalist, the worshiper, the devotee, has to bring about himself. It's a very active mysticism, his own meditation, his own reverent prayer, and his own sexual acts, which are undertaken quite reverently, are enough to bring back the male and female together, and therefore to reintegrate God and reintegrate the cosmos. It's quite a stunning and exhilarating view of reality compared to kind of what was called in the 18th century killjoy Methodism.
Yes, indeed. I was just thinking about that context of the Puritan stream or streak in English Protestantism that was so self-denying and certainly did not celebrate sex openly. Indeed, depictions of sex. It seems that even imagining and painting in one's mind the physical body of Christ was an important practice for the Moravians.
Oh, yes, it was. And unlike most of the Protestant and dissident divisions of Christianity in Britain, they stressed visual art, which it was condemned as papist by the more radical Protestants. They stressed that visual art was so important and to be able to paint it not only on canvas and in watercolors and all kinds of ways, but to always picture Jesus, see him in your mind. And that was the full-bodied Jesus, with both the spear thrust and the sense that he was an androgynous creature also.
So is this why we see in William Blake's painting so much of the nakedness of human beings?
Yes, very much. And as Swedenborg wrote, you know, nakedness is innocence. And he said that when he traveled to heaven and was up there with departed spirits and the angels, they were all going naked, including their servants were all naked, because this was the way that God intended us to be. I don't know if you were going to ask about the story that Blake and his wife were found sitting nude in their garden in Lambeth and welcomed in a visitor and said, oh, it's only Adam and Eve, don't worry about it. And this story was just rejected with horror by many Victorian readers of Blake. But it was quite consistent with his own beliefs and with his Swedenborgian colleagues, including one wonderful missionary, a Scottish missionary who went off to the jungles of South America and walked naked through the jungles, recruiting natives to the New Jerusalem Church.
Well, speaking of missionaries, this is also how the Indian tantric notions came into the Moravian milieu at that time and possibly into Blake's mind as well. Missionaries of the Moravians went to India and they must have seen the very sexually explicit temples.
Oh, yes, they did. And they wrote letters home about it. And the Moravians were very tolerant of other religions. They did not require that people give up a religion in order to become a Moravian. And so it was interesting, in India, they had congregations of both Jews and Asian natives, which was quite an unusual mix. But they brought back these tales, and Zinzendorf recognized the parallels with the techniques of Kabbalah, too, how similar they were in many ways. But what Swedenborg took further from that, and the Swedish, he had many friends in the Swedish East India Company, which brought back all kinds of tracts and manuscripts and artworks from the East. He applied his scientific training, anatomical training, to try to really understand what's involved in these tantric methods of this prolonged arousal, which requires the cremaster muscles, the seminal retention, which requires control of the seminal duct. How does this all work its way up to the brain? And I think what he brought uniquely to religious studies It's this whole physiological analysis of what are very powerful spiritual experiences.
Is there any evidence that William Blake actually tried to achieve these tantric exercises for his spiritual visions?
Well, yes. And he, you know, in his later years, he wrote quite often from Oriental themes, Oriental terminology, and also sketched and drew pictures of himself and his wife in a kind of tantric position. Many of these were censored. We have to remember that most of Blake's most radical and expressive works were destroyed by his executors. So what we have left is the safe Blake, which is kind of astonishing, given how unsafe he really was, or still is. But it made quite clear that he drew upon not only what Swedenborg and Zinzendorf wrote about Asiatic techniques, but also what many of his own colleagues brought back from India, from Italy, etc., about these different fertility religions.
Well, Keith, if so much of Blake's racy work was destroyed, how do we know what he actually depicted?
Well, fortunately, there's a great deal left, but he said he wrote thousands of pages of epic poetry, and we know from his executors that there was a great bonfire done because they were so afraid of much of what he said. So we're really working perhaps with the tip of an iceberg, but it's certainly a very informative tip. We also have his own letters, a lot of his letters still left, and the accounts of his contemporaries. So we get a pretty good notion of it. But as one of his friends said, William Blake may be cracked, but his wife is more cracked than he is. They knew he was even more outré than what we get today in the surviving works of Blake.
Well, could she have been responsible for asking the executor to burn the manuscripts?
Yes, she could very much, because she was quite influenced by the executor, who had become quite pious and religious.
Mm. Well, what's so fascinating to me about that story is that the 18th century is so often remembered for the birth of the Enlightenment and rationalism. And what you have uncovered with so many interesting characters in the Blake milieu is that it was such a seething hotbed of esoteric spiritualism and heterodox ideas and certainly a lot of erotic mythology.
Well, it was also very underground, and it was suppressed not only by church people. The Moravians went through a real effort to burn up many of the documents of the sifting time, and also by modern academics who, are much more rationalist and found all of this just balderdash and rubbish. Who could be interested in it? And because much of this survived in what we know of the Jacobite underground, the people who opposed the Hanoverians, it got kind of written out of history. But there's a great revival in revisionism going on in historical studies of the 18th century. It's no longer just the Augustan age of stuffy people having literary quarrels with each other. But we see that there was an underground tradition that emerged in some of the greatest art and poetry of the age.
Well, even William Butler Yeats, who was no prude, did also become subject to the censorious mind. I mean, he published some of Blake's work, but excluded the very explicit drawings.
Yes, he did. I mean, this was still, Victorian times for Yeats. He became much more explicit as life went on, as he went on, and when he became so interested in Kabbalah and Tantra. And, his wonderful poems of old age, What Else Do I Have to Drive Me But Lust and Rage? And what was interesting for Yeats is it really fueled such beautiful, magnificent poetry. Now, this is what interested me. I'm not a mystic. I'm not into lust and rage and all of these, but I'm very interested in what pushes the creative imagination to the edge, as happened with Blake and Yeats, and also in many ways with James Joyce.
Well, if lust and rage can push the imagination forward, what about the torments of love and jealousy, which Blake wrote about in the Four Zoas? Was this an autobiographical work?
I think it was quite autobiographical. And what was interesting is my discovery that the term Four Zoas came from a Moravian hymn. That was one of these great light bulbs. But it also was composed over years of this struggle with his wife, with himself, and with the dangerous effects of trying to implement what he calls Swedenborg's dangerous sexual religion, because it was it took a real toll on his mental health. We know he had hallucinations, paranoia, faintings, near epileptic faintings at many times, and that he had probably pushed his own mind, as Swedenborg had too, to the point of mental breakdown. At the same time, his wife, who must have worried about all this, and also listened to all the preachers and the critics who, you know, were so terrified of female sexuality. One of the most widely read books was one that claimed that nymphomania was caused by women reading novels and drinking too much chocolate. so that there was real fear put into them by pundits and ministers, etc., that whatever their husbands and these experimenters in the underworld were doing, they were in real danger.
Oh, gosh, it's always the women who take the blame.
Oh, I know, it's chocolate always.
Chocolate and women.
Chocolate, novels, and women.
Well, Keith, just finally, I wonder whether this theme of sexual spirituality ever goes away. When one thinks of the 70s, there were so many different new religious movements or cults or sects or whatever you want to call them that had very similar ideas and practices.
Well, I think Craig Atwood, a wonderful Moravian historian, has summed up this period, the sifting time, as a repeat or a foreshadowing of the Summer of Love in 1968 in San Francisco, when a youth culture terrified their elders as they experimented with sex and psychoactive chemicals and turbulent music. During the sifting time, the young Moravians were all playing guitar, so it really is quite an amazing historical parallel. And it brought damage. It also opened the windows and brought a great deal of fresh air. And I have to say that Zinzendorf is admired as a very creative theologian who was tolerant, who called for the end of slavery, who was very much interested in increasing human rights, etc., so that it wasn't all just sex and scandal. It was also quite a liberating way on many fronts.
Well, Keith Shuhard, your book, Why Mrs. Blake Cried, is certainly a fascinating look into this world and goes well beyond the sexuality of William Blake and into these ideas of universal brotherhood. So I thank you so much for being on The Spirit of Things. It's been great talking to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Marcia Keith Shuhard, who actually goes by the name Keith Shuhard, is the author of Why Mrs. Blake Cried. In America, it's published under the title William Blake's Sexual Path to Spiritual Vision. And she tells me her husband is a T.S. Eliot scholar who's working on a giant project of Eliot's unknown prose works, which go to the thousands of pages. So that's something to look forward to, as is a future conversation with Keith Shuhard about Emanuel Swedenborg, another fascinating figure from the era. She was on the line to me from Atlanta, Georgia. Production today was by me and Jeff Wood, with sound engineering this week by Joe Wallace. You can find The Spirit of Things on the RN homepage, where you can hear the program online or take it with you. Well, Noah's back. Well, the Russell Crowe version of him, which is making a splash. I couldn't resist that. But just what is Noah's legacy, and what can we learn from him that we can't learn from Russell? Find out next week right here on The Spirit of Things with me, Rachel Kahn, on RN.
After hearing Thelonious Monk, I couldn't go back and listen to Oscar anymore. It didn't make sense.
Don Walker. He joined me, Lucky Oceans, as a guest programmer on a couple of recent Daily Planet programs and shared his philosophies of music. If you miss them, you can still catch them and many other Daily Planet programs online. Just look for the Daily Planet on the RN homepage.